Welcome to this exciting episode of Talking Pork, the podcast created for the food service industry. I'm your host, Vanessa Barnes, Business Development Manager, Food Service Australian Pork. Today we are talking about all things molecular gastronomy. I was fortunate enough to be able to attend a workshop where Brian Steele was the facilitator, and I could not believe how interesting this man is and just what molecular gastronomy means and what you can create from that. So our guest today, as I mentioned, is Brian Steele, and I would like to welcome you, Brian.
Thanks, Vanessa. It's good to be here.
Thank you for joining us. I really am looking forward to just going through the concept of molecular gastronomy and you talking about it in your words and what it actually means. So, Brian, tell us your story. You've got a really interesting background, and it's one that may surprise so many of our listeners.
Before I actually got into the world of hospitality, restaurants and food, and as a food academic with a master's degree in gastronomy, obviously I've got a fairly long background in the military where I was flying lots of things in lots of countries across many militaries from both British and Australian. So, yeah, I certainly had some interesting times. But now I tend to spend more of my time, feeding people rather than, trying to,
Fly a plane.
Go to other places around the world.
What would you prefer?
Well, look, I like them both. You know, I've been very lucky in that when I was very young, I was passionate about flying, and I was at a point where I was, paid to do something I would pay to do. And now I've always been passionate about food and the meaning behind food and cuisines. And so I'm now in a situation where I can pursue that passion as well. So I've been very lucky, I think.
You have been. Yeah. And you're just so smart.
Well, no, I've just read a lot of books. I've been lucky. I've been taught by some very smart people, I think.
Oh, well, whatever it is, it's working and it engages me, and I love having conversations with you.
Thanks.
So tell me, Brian, what is molecular gastronomy? I've seen it. I know what it is, but I don't understand the concept behind it.
Sure. So it's often a word that's not liked much by all of the people that you will be familiar with, the likes of Ferran Adria and Grant Achatz and Heston Blumenthal. They're all not very comfortable with the concept because, of course, it was generated by Hervé Thies and his Oppo in Germany way back when, where they were scientists actually looking at, the molecular element of science behind cooking and the chemistry, most importantly, behind it. Whereas they were more about just understanding the why. And really, answering the question is more about what molecular gastronomy isn't. So it's not a style of cooking. It's not a type of cuisine. It's actually understanding the why about dishes. So it's applying the same scientific, intellectual, and technical rigor to cooking that we do to everything else, from mobile phones to stereos to cars. If you think that most chefs, most knights in Sydney are using core recipes that were codified by Escoffier in the early 1900s, and a lot of those haven't changed since. So think about what do we still use from the early 1900s now that isn't anything to do with food? And so understanding why things happen as they do is actually the main approach, in that it's not about style of a substance, it's not novelty for novelty's sake, it's just doing things better. And in fact, one of the most powerful things of molecular gastronomy, or modernist cuisine, as they like to call it now, is, and this will resonate with chefs because this is a profound statement, if you think that most of the things you do when it comes to applying modernist techniques is you can worry about flavor first and then figure out texture later. And that is probably the most powerful thing. And the example I often use, just to kind of like make it more approachable and let people understand, is that the best example for molecular gastronomy, as it were, is if you're making a custard, and if we all grew up cooking on our parents' mother's apron strings like I did, you add eggs and cream and sugar and maybe some vanilla, and you stir it, and it's like, it'll start to thicken as you heat it. And then, keep going until it coats the back of a spoon. But if you go too far, you got scrambled eggs. Mm. Okay, that's not very useful because you fail like 12 times before you get it right. But the really high-tech molecular gastronomy bit is, if you understand the magical properties of the egg yolk and understand that, you know, the long chains of amino acids and they link and they unfurl and they connect at certain temperatures, you then go back to the molecular approach to making custard, which is do everything I just said and then reach for a thermometer. And when you hit 82 degrees, you're done. And that is molecular gastronomy.
But it just seems so common sense.
I know, but it's just understanding the why thing. It's just the why thing. And I guess the reason I got such an affinity to this approach is maybe I was the annoying kid that always said why. But the point is, I always wanted to understand why, because when you understand why, it gives you more flexibility in the application, but it also reduces the risk of failure. And so in the hospitality world where, you know, the cost of goods is massive and the margins are ridiculously small, anything you can do to either broaden your portfolio whilst reducing the risk of failure and also maximizing every ingredient has got to be a good thing.
Absolutely. How important is sensory when it comes to the molecular?
Oh, so, I mean, it's massively important. I mean, I've been, you know, this is the academic in me coming through, but I've always been really fascinated by the meaning behind food. And of course, you know, cuisines are by their very nature a dynamic beast. So the authenticity debate about where pasta came from and where tomato sauce came from is always interesting. But look, you know, food has tremendous meaning, and so taste resonates through memory. Smell is a really important element. And if you think about, you know, think about when you listen to a song and it reminds you of something from your youth, well, that same thing happens with a smell and also can happen with a taste. And so understanding how our memories and how our culture and our environment influences what we taste is one of the things that Heston Blumenthal does very well, as you're all aware. I mean, he really delves into the history and the meaning behind food. But of course, it's more than just food. It's apart from the fact that it's the only thing we need to do to sustain ourselves, you know, it's the only thing that we have to do, we have to eat. But it links to family, it links to history, it links to tradition, it links to meaning. And all of these things come out when you start exploring the why thing, especially when you're trying to figure out look at the more intricate elements, the scientific elements of just cooking in general.
And when it comes to, I had dinner one night. I was fortunate enough. There's a little place up in Nelson's Bay. It was called Ritual.
Yep.
And they start with the sweet and the sour.
Yep.
So you try two different, try two different, what would you call it?
Combinations or elements, two different courses.
You start with a sweet profile and then you have a sour profile. Yep. And then you decide which you're in the mood for that night, and that then will dictate how you are ordering your menu or what your menu is going to comprise of. And I was amazed. They'd get you to stand on some green carpet, but it was to look like grass.
Yep.
And then they would have, you know, the different textures on the wall that you would pick off. And it was all about the whole experience. Mm-hmm. And does that play a big role in that creating science in food as well?
Well, I think it does, and more aligned with the fact that now that we understand more about what influence touch and sound and taste and memory has, it allows you to then, that's just another, so it's basically it's another part of the recipe. Yeah. So you've got all these ingredients that you chop up and you fry up and you saute and you steam and you boil. And then the other ingredients are other things that can be sound. I mean, obviously another, one of my masters of gastronomy, colleagues, Neil Gao, he's the one to talk to more about this, because his area of expertise is more about like techno-emotional cuisine and gastrophysics. So he did a really in-depth study into everything that surrounds the food.
Okay.
I looked more about the influence of the media on restaurants and on food. So if you combine those two things, then yeah, sound is really important. Touch is really important. In fact, one of the interesting stories about, you know, the fat duck coming to Melbourne and where they brought that Sound of the Sea dish with them. And in the first couple of weeks, apparently it wasn't really resonating as much with people. So normally then when they'd say to people, did you like the dish? The reaction was, oh, it was awesome. The sound of the ocean, it was great. But they were getting just a bit, people going, yeah, it was really delicious, thanks. And I think it was one of the chefs was just listening to the thing on a loop, and he realized that it was, the sound they were using was a British beach.
Oh.
And of course, pebbles with water over them sound different to sand with water over them. So they went over and recorded an Australian beach, and have a guess what happened when they asked the next lot of people how they thought the dish was. They were like, it's awesome. It's great. It was delicious. So
isn't
that sound.
Interesting.
Yeah. Like I say, that's Neil's area of expertise. So you should probably speak to him next, actually, because he's a mine of information when it comes to that sort of thing.
You'll have to give me his details.
Yeah, definitely.
So when it comes to science and food, what is your go-to product? What ingredient is it that you have to have?
Oh, that's an interesting question. So I guess if you go back to what I said right at the very beginning, which is really apart from, you know, people who like to do foams or people who do, you know, strange crackling things or whatever, I don't know. I mean, if we just go back to texture, bear in mind that as Westerners, just in general, we're very sensitive to texture. And then if you think about other nations, you know, in the world, in the Japanese language, there are more than 75 words to describe texture. And so the things that I concentrate most on is how you can manipulate texture to make something taste better. And obviously that applies to sauces, and it also applies to how you cook meat. And so it's funny, my two favorite ingredients in terms of just in the modernist space are quite unusual ones. One of them is sodium citrate, which is, it's an acid, but it's not quite as acidic as, you know, lemon juice. But it's also does things where it's called a sequestrant and emulsifier. But what that means is it basically allows you to make the best macaroni cheese sauce ever. And it also allows you to make your own designer processed cheese slices for your best toasted cheese sandwich, right? I mean, it's just a staggering ingredient. They use potassium citrate in Kraft cheese slices. Sodium citrate is just another way of doing it. So pick your three favorite cheeses, mix them with a bottle of your favorite beer, you know, add a certain percentage of sodium citrate, pour on a Silpat mat, and what you have there is a perfect toasted cheese sandwich slice that does all that stringiness that you can put between bread. It's awesome. And the other one, which is
Instagrammable.
It's Instagrammable, totally. You can make little templates of the same size of cheese around the same size of bread you use, you know. And but the other one is just a way of, because it's more old school than anything else, but it's just a way of thickening a sauce to make it a little bit thick and glossy, as if you finished it off with butter but without adding flour. So there's something called Ultraspurse. There's Ultratex and Ultraspurse. And it's just a highly refined starch. But it means that without worrying about temperature, without worrying about mixing it with water first, you can just have a sauce that is just at the right taste. It's just perfectly balanced, but it's still a little bit thin. And if you don't want to reach for the cornstarch or anything else, you just randomly sprinkle some of this stuff on and whisk it. And what you end up with is this glossy, shiny, thick sauce with a great texture where you've had to add no flour, and so it doesn't interrupt with any of the intensity of the flavor. So those are the two things I probably use the most.
Wow.
You know, I can spherify a cocktail, and I can, you know, I can do all sorts of stuff, and I've got a sous vide machine at home and everything like that, which is great for just doing good stuff. But those are the two ingredients that probably give me the most joy, because it's good, of course, it's mac and cheese, and it's, you know, great sauces.
And cheese on toast.
And cheese on toast. And toasted cheese sandwiches, which is food groups everywhere. Yeah.
So is there anything else that you feel would be of interest to our listeners that we haven't perhaps covered when we're talking about this subject?
Oh, look, I think when I'm thinking about, you know, designing dishes, or when I'm working with other restaurateurs or chefs in this space, I guess the thing that modernist cuisine allows you to do more than anything else, especially, again, coming back to the texture thing, is if I'm assessing a dish for, you know, whether it's A, tasty when you start the dish and stays tasty and interesting all the way through, there are three elements that I'm always thinking about when it comes to whether something really resonates. And it penetrates the sort of like the cultural and the semiotic, as it were, in terms of how things, the meaning behind things. But so taste, temperature, and texture are the three things that make a dish exciting all the way through. Yeah, mm-hmm. You can have a dish where you take a mouthful and go, oh my God, it's delicious. And then by the end of it, if it's monotextural, you're going, well, yeah, okay, just kind of got a bit boring vanilla towards the end. Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. Whereas if it's got textural contrast, if it's got an interesting temperature contrast, maybe, and then if the taste is balanced, I mean, you mentioned earlier about the sort of like sweet sour. I mean, understanding the sort of like the physiology of taste, as it were. I mean, that modernist cuisine, it's also about understanding the difference between taste and flavor, and then understanding where the balances are. And so, you know, sweet and sour in opposition, and salt and bitter in opposition. So just the other day, a chef gave me this dish where there was just some lovely marinated olives, and these olives were really delicious, but the bitterness came through, that really nice olive oil bitterness. Mm-hmm. But it was quite a bit of sourness. And I said, look, it doesn't need salt to make it salty, but it needs salt to bring that bitterness back. And he looked at me really confused. I went, just try it. And he sprinkled some salt on, had another olive, and went, oh my God, that worked. I'm like, yeah, just understanding that balance of the sweet, sour, salt, bitter, like matrix, if you will. Umami sits out there looking on all of them, obviously, that mouthfeel. And then understand how that influences the core part of a dish. And then obviously flavors, which is more about the smell or the retronasal or analeptic stuff or whatever it's called. So understanding the why and understanding how you can influence taste and then understanding how you can manipulate texture means that it is just another tool for your toolbox. I mean, the molecular gastronomy is not the answer to everything. Some dishes just are great and they don't need to be messed with. Mm. But some understanding how other things work, whether it's using a pressure cooker and whether it's using anything else, gives you that flexibility, either understanding pressure cookers for doing meats quicker, or, you know, a lot of Italian chefs will threaten my life when I say this, but also realizing that you can do, you know, a perfect risotto in 5 minutes, 30 seconds in a pressure cooker. Honestly.
Which I actually went and tried.
There you go. Excellent. I'm glad. So really, it really does come down to it's being inquisitive. It's not about understanding science. It's not about spending a fortune on a centrifuge and a vacuum chamber machine and an anti-griddle. It's about understanding what you can do in a normal restaurant kitchen or home kitchen with the equipment you have by manipulating texture or temperature or taste, and making things either the taste cleaner or just making things more exciting.
I also think that it's also about another way to use ingredients that normally may have gone in the bin.
Absolutely.
We look at fat, for example, and we made an amazing dust from bacon fat.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
so you think about the hotels or cafes that are having bacon on breakfasts that have got fat that they're ultimately just tipping in the bin.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can add a couple of ingredients to that or molecular
maltodextrin.
Yep. What is it?
Maltodextrin, tapioca maltodextrin, yeah.
And you then just have this amazing dust.
Yeah, exactly. And then you add a little bit of sugar to it. You add a little bit of sugar to that bacon dust, and then you make some pancakes with some butter on top and sprinkle that, and you got you got pancakes with bacon and sugar powder.
That's really amazing.
That sort of stuff.
Yes.
So, yeah, you're right. And then understanding how to maximize every ingredient by either using a dehydrator. Anybody who's got a juicer, any pulp from any juicer can then be put into a dehydrator, turned into a powder, mixed 50-50 with salt. Now you've got either a vegetable salt or a fruit salt. You're right. It definitely puts less in the bin. And it allows you especially when you're scaling up for either through restaurants or all the way up through, you know, catering, high-end catering through hotels, the smallest saving and the broader you can apply ingredients, the bigger the saving, which is an attractive concept across every element of hospitality.
And that's probably the two fundamental exciting components that I really enjoy about the molecular gastronomy. So, Brian, tell us what you're up to now. What is it that you're doing?
So I'm doing some sort of like consulting work linked to my old life in the military. But I'm also I'm increasingly working with restaurants and trying to maybe help restaurant groups in both helping with menu design and dish development, but also looking at the sort of like the human factors and the team building and the communication element to the front of house to try and increase the efficiencies there, just in terms of service model, because of course with an inherently transitory employment model, you know, your training is really important. With a background in training, I find that really interesting. And I'm actually peripherally, I'm actually involved in introducing a new drink into the market, which is this new concept of mixing a coffee with a fruit juice using a proprietary brewing method, which, you know, the upshot is that we've come up with something that is really, really high in antioxidants and quite low in calories and is really, really delicious. So I'm sort of getting to the point where hopefully we're getting to a fundraising element for that, and we did a market trial. It went on the shelves and people liked it.
Well, that's good.
Yeah,
that's always a great first step.
Exactly. But it's understanding, you know, it's that weird, it loops back to the molecular gastronomy bit, where understanding that, you know, the You know, some things have antioxidants in them, so polyphenols, as they're called, but just because it has them doesn't mean they are bioavailable. So our brewing method is unlocking the bioavailability of the antioxidants in coffee, or more of them, and also understanding that there's a potentiating effect on caffeine that comes from natural sugars that means that you get a boost from a smaller amount of caffeine, and that comes with antioxidants. So understanding those things means that, again, just making something that, A, rule number one, has got to taste delicious, which goes across everything, we've then managed to figure out a way to make it, you know, a little bit more healthy and lower in calories. People are very, you know, conscious these days of sugar and salt and fat and, you know, which, none of which are bad for you, but obviously just maybe less is a little bit better. So, yeah, so that's what I've been doing.
Ah, oh, I can't wait to try it. Yeah. It sounds really interesting.
Yeah, it's really good fun.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Tell us, what book, if someone wanted to learn more about the molecular gastronomy, okay, what book could you suggest that they read?
Right. That's a really easy answer. So On Food and Cooking by Harold McGee is a great place to start. It's a big book. It's a long read, but it's endlessly fascinating. And it's the book that contains all of the whys and all of the what's and the so what's and the how's across just about every ingredient. And Harold McGee is a very good writer and extremely knowledgeable.
I think you can get that digital now as well.
You can get it digitally, yes. So you can get it on your iPad, you can get it on your e-reader, or you can just go and do the old-fashioned way and buy the book. But that's the one book. If you wanted to start somewhere and have a book that gives you the foundation across everything, that's the one.
That's fantastic. Yeah. How do people get in contact with you?
So I set up a company last year after I'd sort of like departed the military, and because my parents gave me a cool last name, Steele, I figured I'd set up a company called Steele Edge. So my website, which is steeleedge.com.au, has all of my details, and you can contact me through there, and it's got my bio and all that sort of stuff. So there you go.
Thank you so much, Brian. I've really found this fascinating today.
Thanks for having
it's
me
been
on.
A great conversation, and I look forward to chefs reaching out and telling us what they're doing in the molecular space.
Absolutely, always happy to help.
Thank you so
Excellent.
Much.
Thanks, Vanessa.
For more information, please email us at inspired@australianpork.com.au or sign up to receive our informative newsletters at www.inspiredbyaustralianpork.com.au. Until next time, I'm Vanessa Barnes, and don't forget, get more pork on your menu.